from deep inside your radio.
It looks like London. It feels like Miami. It must be New Orleans. Hello. Ladies and gentlemen, I noted on this broadcast a few weeks ago the then meteoric rise of the concept of the trillion-dollar platinum coin that had, just at that point, broken through to, if you consider MSNBC the mainstream, which I do, they're owned by Comcast, it had just broken through at that point. Now, this week, it has reached its zenith, its apogee. It is falling back to earth because late yesterday, I believe, or sometime yesterday, as we originate this program live on Sunday, the Treasury Department of President Obama announced, we're not going to mint. That was Mitch McConnell's word for it. We're not going to print a platinum coin. So apparently he has a 3D printer in his house. But the Treasury said, we're not going to mint a platinum coin. So from obscure blog posts to a denial by the Treasury Department, the trillion-dollar platinum coin is clearly, this early in the year, the meme of the year. Congratulations, platinum coin. There's a dozen Ship and Shore blouses waiting for you. Now, ladies and gentlemen, President Obama met with President Karzai this week to discuss the future of what is now indubitably, has been for a while, America's longest war. Aren't you proud to be alive when we've done that? According to the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, John Sopko, at $28 million a day, the United States has spent more money rebuilding Afghanistan during the last 11 years than we spent rebuilding Germany after World War II. So where's the Afghan Beetle? I want to drive it now. But since we are at this moment where the two presidents agreed we're going to continue the war, but we're going to continue it differently, and there are going to be fewer troops, but we don't know how many, but we're, it goes on. It might be time, since this whole thing started as a war against Al-Qaeda, 11 years, billions, maybe trillions of dollars spent in that cause. Maybe it's time to ask the question that you'd never hear asked or answered. How big is Al-Qaeda? From the Wall Street Journal, 2010, a dozen terrorism scholars gave a wide range of answers when asked to estimate how many members there are, how the numbers have changed during the lifespan of the group, and how many countries the group operates in. Analysts put the core membership at anywhere from 200 to 1,000. The next level of affiliated fighters or funders is made up of thousands or tens of thousands. Long War Journal, 2011. A note in a press release, at the bottom of a press release from the allies in Afghanistan, that more than 25 Al-Qaeda operatives and leaders were killed in Afghanistan over 1 month in 2011. So in the last month, coalition forces at this point, coalition forces had killed more than 25 Al-Qaeda leaders. This certainly calls into question the much-touted intelligence estimate on Al-Qaeda strength in Afghanistan. In 2010, CIA Director Leon Panetta floated the estimate on national TV, quote, I think at most we're looking at maybe 50 to 100 Al-Qaeda operatives in Afghanistan, maybe less. It's in that vicinity. And General Petraeus repeated the estimate later in 2011. So the Long War Journal asked in that year, why is the estimate of Al-Qaeda strength in Afghanistan remained static for nearly a year? What is the intelligence community's present estimate of Al-Qaeda strength in Afghanistan? Can the estimate be revised downward to 25 to 75 Al-Qaeda operatives, given the results of operations over the then past month? From the Telegraph in London, last year, 2012, a full list of 170 named Al-Qaeda members first discovered in Osama bin Laden's compound in Afghanistan has been published. That's 170. With bin Laden himself registered at number one. Modesty was not, apparently, one of his vices. AP, Associated Press, 2012. Al-Qaeda is rebuilding in Iraq and has set up training camps for insurgents in the nation's western deserts as the group seizes on regional instability and government security failures to regain strength, say officials. Now, Iraqi and U.S. officials say, this is 2012, the insurgent group has more than doubled its numbers from a year ago, from about 1,000 to slightly more than 2,000 fighters. Eleven years, billions, trillions of dollars fighting against, the largest estimate was thousands, tens of thousands. Job well done, boys and girls. Hello, welcome to the show. From the edge of Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of Le Show. Ladies and gentlemen, the federal judiciary seems to be slowly waking from its slumbers. Last week we had the opinion of Federal Judge McMahon in New York ruling against a lawsuit ordering the that would have ordered the United States government to release the reasons, legal justification for targeted assassination, but denouncing the legal thicket of catch-22s that prohibited her from ruling in favor of the plaintiffs. Now comes, as they say in the lawsuits, a federal judge in San Francisco who indignantly rejected an attempt by the Obama administration to use secret evidence to derail a former Stanford student's challenge to her inclusion on the no-fly list. The government must halt its, quote, persistent and stubborn refusal to follow the applicable laws, says U.S. District Judge William Alsup. It regards Rahina Ibrahim, well, there you go. See what I mean? Already. A Stanford graduate student in January 2005 when she was stopped at San Francisco Airport and prevented from boarding a flight to Malaysia, where she's from. Arrested and jailed briefly by San Francisco police, she was allowed to take the flight the next day with her 14-year-old daughter. When she tried to return 2 months later, she was again stopped and told she was subject to arrest. The U.S. consulate said her student visa had been revoked under a terrorism law. She eventually earned her Stanford doctorate abroad and is a professor in Malaysia. She settled claims against police and others involved in her arrest for $225,000, but still challenging her inclusion on the no-fly list. Now, President Obama's Justice Department privately contacted the judge last fall and said an agent would arrive shortly carrying evidence for dismissal of the suit. According to the judge's description of the phone call, the agent would then retrieve the evidence and take it back to headquarters while the judge wrote his ruling, all without notice to the lawyers of the person involved. Ibrahim Alsop, who had dismissed the suit twice before and had been overruled both times by a federal appeals court, said the government's actions this time were, quote, too hard to swallow. Legal precedents, he said, favor maintenance of our traditional system of fair play in which both sides have notice of the arguments and evidence being used against them. He criticized the Justice Department for arguing that Ibrahim's lawyers couldn't be, quote, trusted to handle sensitive information, noting that federal agencies had cleared the lawyers to review confidential information in the case years ago. The judges awaken. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for me to read the trades for you. There's a lot to awaken to, judges. Reading the trades for you. First, from Ad Age. CNET disqualifies contender from awards over battle with its parent. What? I'll read it for you. Don't worry about it. The sensitive nature of media ownership came to the forefront of the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas this week when Dish Network's latest version of its Hopper digital video recorder was disqualified from CNET's Best of CES Awards. The reason? CNET's parent, CBS, is suing Dish over the Hopper's technology, specifically its ability to skip commercials. Dish used this year's CES show to introduce the Hopper with Sling, which allows consumers to watch live or recorded TV on devices both on and offline. CNET, a major technology website, named the device a finalist for its Best of CES Awards, praising it in a review that said the DVR, quote, almost has it all. But CNET pulled Dish as a finalist at the last minute. Quote, the Dish Hopper with Sling was removed from consideration due to active litigation involving our parent company, CBS Corporation, CNET said on its website. We are saddened that CNET staff is being denied its editorial independence because of CBS's heavy-handed tactics, said the CEO of Dish Network. This action has nothing to do with the merits of our new product. Using Sling's technology essentially spares Dish the pain of securing rights from each individual content provider, a laborious route that has slowed the pay TV industry's effort to allow viewing across devices and hopefully fend off streaming video upstarts. Everybody loves competition, don't they? And from the American Banker, big banks flunk risk tests. What? Think corporate governance at the largest banks is weak? You're right, but you probably have no idea just how right you are. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency recently graded the 19 largest national banks on five factors designed to gauge how well they're being run. The results are startling. Not a single bank met the OCC's requirements for internal auditing, risk management, or succession planning. Only two of the 19 banks met the regulator's requirements for defining the company's appetite for risk-taking and communicating it across the company. Only two banks were judged to have boards of directors willing and able to stand up to their chief executives. That miserable picture was painted by Office of the Comptroller of the Currency leaders last month at a closed-door conference for large bank directors. Says Mike Brosnan, an agency veteran who leads large bank supervision. I think we're a C-plus, B-minus point. And what we're looking to get to is B-plus or A-minus. We're not looking for A-plus, unquote. They're just big banks. Why should they be A-plus? Brosnan predicted each of the 19 banks will meet the agency's thresholds in at least one of the five categories by July. All these are motherhood and apple pie, he says, but they're really hard to do. An average of 57 separate problems were cited at each of the 19 banks. The big banks flunk. Who would have thunk it? Yes, it's a rhetorical question. The kind that occurs to me when I read the trades for you. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And on a related subject, the new F-bomb, ladies and gentlemen, foreclosure is back in the news thanks to the folks at Reuters News Agency. They have discovered a new thing, a new twist, in our lack of sobriety, called zombie title. No, it's not some lazy Hollywood scriptwriter failing to come up with a name for his new horror film. Zombie title, a little-known horror of the U.S. housing bust, the zombie title, 6 years in to the foreclosure bomb. Thousands of homeowners are finding themselves legally liable for houses they didn't know they still owned because banks decided it wasn't worth their while to complete the foreclosures on them. With impunity, banks have been walking away from foreclosures much the way some homeowners walked away from their mortgages. The banks are just deciding not to foreclose, even though the homeowners never caught up with their payments, says Vice President Darren Blomquist of Realty Track. Since 2006, 10 million homes have been foreclosed on, according to Realty Track, a number that in earlier times would have taken nearly two decades to reach. Of these, more than 2 million have never come out. Some may be occupied by owners who are living gratis. Others have been caught up in the robo-signing scandal. And then there are thousands of foreclosures in limbo just hanging out there, just sitting with nothing being done, says Cleveland Housing Court Judge Raymond Pianca, whose pending court cases tied to derelict properties have doubled in the past 2 years. He says the surge is due largely to homes vacated by people who fled before an imminent foreclosure sale, only to learn later they remain legally responsible for their house. When people move out after receiving a notice of a planned foreclosure sale and the bank then cancels, municipalities are left to deal with the mess. Some spend public funds on securing, clearing, and stabilizing houses that generate no tax revenue. Others let the houses rot. In at least three states, in recent months, houses abandoned by owners and banks have exploded because the gas was never shut off. House go boom. Unsuspecting homeowners have had their wages garnished, their credit destroyed, and their tax refunds seized. They've opened their mail to find bills for back taxes, graffiti scrubbing services, demolition crews, trash removal, gutter repair, exterior cleaning, and lawn clipping. At their front doors, they've encountered bailiffs brandishing summonses to appear in court. In some cities, people with zombie titles can be sentenced to probation with the threat of jail if they don't fix up their houses that they didn't think were their houses anymore. These people have become like indentured serfs with all of the responsibilities for the properties, but none of the rights, says law professor Kermit Lind. Banks used to almost always follow through with foreclosures. That's changed since the housing crash. Financial institutions have realized that following through on sale of decaying houses in markets swamped with foreclosures may not yield anything close to what is owed on them. This is why Eve Smith, frequent guest on this program, and others have advocated that the banks give principal modifications to the homeowners, they'll get more out of them than they will by foreclosing. This is the result of not doing that. By walking away, banks can at least reap the insurance. That was me interposing. Now I'm returning to the Reuters story. By walking away, banks can at least reap the insurance tax and accounting benefits from documenting the loss without having to take on any of the costs and responsibilities of ownership. That's according to the Federal Reserve. A walkaway also enables them to sell the unpaid debt to debt collectors. That's fun. No regulations require that banks let homeowners know when they change their minds about foreclosure, says a judge of the Buffalo, New York Housing Court. His zombie title caseload has swollen to well into the hundreds. The whole situation, he says, is surreal. That word's being overused these days, don't you think? Maybe it's what we're living through. The new F-bomb, ladies and gentlemen. Foreclosure. How things going in the new Iraq? Here's catching up on some of the great stuff that happened earlier on. A defense contractor whose subsidiary... This is my chair squeaking, by the way. A defense contractor whose subsidiary was accused in a lawsuit of conspiring to torture detainees at Abu Ghraib has paid $5.2 million to 71 former inmates held there and at other U.S.-run detention sites between 2003 and 2007. The settlement in the case involved Engility Holdings, not Agility, Engility, in Chantilly, Virginia. It was this first successful effort by lawyers for former Abu Ghraib prisoners and other detention centers to collect money from a U.S. defense contractor in lawsuits alleging torture. Another contractor is expected to go to trial over similar allegations this summer. Funny, Colin Powell all but said this morning on Meet the Press, the United States didn't torture. What he did was quote George Bush as saying that, so you can't quite pin it on Colin Powell. Odd. The payments were disclosed in a document that Engility filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission a couple months ago, uncovered by the Associated Press more recently. The actual defendant in the lawsuit, L3 Services, now an Engility subsidiary, provided translators to the U.S. military in Iraq, more than 6,000 of them in 2006. On Tuesday, a lawyer for the ex-detainees, Bahar Azmi, said that each of the 71 Iraqis received a portion of the settlement. He declined to say how this money was distributed among them, much like the homeowners in the new federal foreclosure settlement. Private military contractors played a serious but often underreported role in the worst abuses at Abu Ghraib, said Azmi. We're pleased that this settlement provides some accountability. Eric Ruff, Engility's director of corporate communications, had nothing to say because it involved a lawsuit. L3 Services permitted scores of its employees to participate in torturing and abusing prisoners over an extended period of time throughout Iraq, said the lawsuit. The company willfully failed to report L3 employees' repeated assaults and other criminal conduct by its employees to the United States or Iraq authorities. Mock execution, slammed into a wall until he became unconscious, stripped naked and threatened with rape, forced to consume so much water he began to vomit blood. These are some of the things that happened to the detainees, according to their testimony. Several of the inmates said they were raped, and many of the inmates said they were beaten and kept naked for extended periods of time. Abu Ghraib, ladies and gentlemen, echoes down the years in the new Iraq. And now... Follow the dollar. Following the dollar, the conversion to electronic health records. You know, the Obama administration's made so much about that. It has failed so far to produce the hoped-for savings in healthcare costs and has had mixed results. at improving efficiency in patient care, according to a new analysis by the influential Rand Corporation. Optimistic predictions by Rand in 2005 helped drive the explosive growth in the electronic records industry and encouraged the federal government to give billions of dollars in financial incentives to hospitals and doctors that put the systems in place. Rand's 2005 report that started all this was paid for by a group of companies, including General Electric and Cerner Corporation, companies that have profited by developing and selling electronic record systems to hospitals and physicians. Cerner's revenue has nearly tripled since the report was released to a projected $3 billion this year from $1 billion in 2005. That report predicted that widespread use of electronic records could save the United States healthcare system at least $81 billion a year, a figure Rand now says was overstated. But it was paid for. And when crucial, this from Nature, when crucial medical results are at hand, cardiologist Jean-Luc Vachieri knows that the hedge fund managers will come calling. Vachieri, who tests experimental therapies for a rare condition called pulmonary arterial hypertension, is privy to confidential information about critical trials that could be valuable if used illegally to guide investments. As such, his conversations with the financial sector can be terse. He, like about 35,000 academics, is a member of the Gershon-Lehrman Group, one of about 40 expert network companies proliferating in the United States and elsewhere that connect clients, often from the financial industry, with experts who can provide technical information. One of its most prestigious experts, Cindy Gilman, a neurologist, admitted to tipping off a hedge fund manager about clinical trial data before they were made public. The result, $276 million in illicit gains for the hedge fund. That's just one in a string of SEC probes launched since 2009 into whether expert networks are trafficking insider information to the financial industry. The investigation has already led to charges against nearly 30 people with connections to expert networks, and is continuing to yield fresh targets, particularly in the healthcare industry. It highlights the tightrope that researchers walk when they consult for the financial industry for rates that can reach $1,000 per hour. The only reason anybody wants to talk to you from a financial company is for insider information, says Arthur Kaplan, a bioethicist at NYU. That's the start of the story, and that's the end of the story. Unquote. Follow the dollar. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
There was a moon out in space, but a think left to say. The night we called it a day. The night we called it a day. The night we called it.
This is Le Show, and now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Dateline Beijing, fast food giant KFC's parent company, Yum Brands. It's really, not really their name. Has apologized to Chinese consumers in connection with a tainted chicken scare that has hurt sales in the company's leading market. They have not, however, offered to change their name to Yik Brands yet. Yum blamed a breakdown in its supply chain and said it didn't notify regulators fast enough about high levels of antiviral drugs and hormones used to speed up growth in some of its poultry. We regret our failures, and on behalf of Yum China, I apologize sincerely to everyone, said Sam Su, Yum China's chief executive. Some of the tainted meat was reported by the official Chinese television, which conducted a one-year investigation of suppliers in the province. Farmers told the broadcasters some birds would grow too fat to walk because of the hormones they were fed. Too fat to fight. ESPN has apologized for commentator Brett Musburger. Still, remarks about an Alabama quarterback, A.J. McCarron's girlfriend, Catherine Webb, during Monday's BCS National Championship game. During the game, Musburger, 73, repeatedly gushed about the attractiveness of Webb, the reigning Miss Alabama, while she watched the game from the stands. An ESPN rep apologized after the remarks lit up Twitter, with many deeming them creepy. ESPN said, we always try to capture interesting storylines, and the relationship between an Auburn grad who's Miss Alabama and the current Alabama quarterback certainly met that test. However, we apologize that the commentary in this instance went too far. And Brent understands that. Unquote. Leaving just a few questions about what Brent doesn't understand. Canada Post, that's the post office in Canada, hence the name, has issued an apology after pamphlets featuring a nude adult actress were delivered to homes in Halifax, Nova Scotia. The flyer offered an exclusive invite from Bree Olson. Is anybody named Bree not in porn? A former porn star and one of Charlie Sheen's consorts during his 2011 meltdown. Once opened, a nude Olson is shown alongside ads for various sex toys. Canada Post offered a mea culpa for the mix-up, claiming it intercepted most but not all of the pamphlets before they were sent out. Canada Post apologizes to anyone who was offended by the mailing. It did not meet our product requirements and should not have been delivered, said a spokesperson. On Twitter, Bree Olson denied any involvement with the junk mail and expressed concern that the images used were out of date. Quote, so old. You're older now, babe. Chris Spence, another Canadian apology. Chris Spence resigned as director of education for the Toronto School Board District. He'd already apologized for plagiarizing portions of an opinion piece published in the Toronto Star, and more allegations of plagiarism had surfaced. Parts of his dissertation, submitted in 1996 for his PhD from the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education, appear to have been copied from unattributed sources as well. Gee, nobody would plagiarize their thesis or dissertation, would they? In a letter of apology published on the Toronto School Board's website, Spence said he planned to enroll in an ethics course at a Toronto university that included teaching on how to avoid plagiarism. That session should last about 14 minutes, sir. You'll be out in plenty of time for lunch. After a security guard at Whole, how to avoid plagiarism? Don't copy. Class, what did I say?
Don't copy.
Thank you. You're dismissed. After a security guard at get paid for the whole semester, though. After a security guard at Whole Foods shamed her autistic brother, Emily Goldman took to the internet to get the store to apologize and to change their staff training policies. Goldman's brother, Michael, who doesn't speak, took some food from the hot bar as the two shopped at a Whole Foods in Milwaukee. Goldman told the she immediately apologized to the security guard on the scene, explained her brother's condition, and offered to pay for the food. The response, they told me he needed to get out of the store and not come back unless he was on a leash, she said. She launched a petition on change.org. Whole Foods, stop treating adults with autism like they're animals, she said. I thought we were animals. I thought that's the kingdom. We're not plants. I see what she means, but still, ladies and gentlemen, we are, you know, like other animals, maybe. The petition garnered more than 1,000 signatures, encouraged Whole Foods to apologize and to set up a training session for the staff at the Milwaukee store, and the security guard who made the inflammatory comment has resigned. Not natural, not organic. A Chinese city government has apologized for taking 5 days to report a chemical leak that has affected another city's drinking water supply. That's not nice. Aniline, 9 tons of it had leaked into a river and contaminated the water supply in Handan City. It's used in manufacturing polyurethane and it can be toxic to humans. Nothing to worry about. Children, this is the not the end, but the latest in this story I was sharing with you from Britain earlier, late last year, about Jimmy Savile. Sort of a combination in terms of his work, in terms of his gigs, of Dick Clark and Mr. Rogers. Did children's shows, did rock and roll shows for teens. Children as young as 8 were abused by Savile, a report detailing 50 years of allegations has revealed. Scotland Yard outlined offenses at 13 hospitals. Some 214 crimes were recorded across 28 police force areas, including 34 of rape. The Crown Prosecution Service, that's the prosecution service, apologized for missing the opportunity to prosecute Savile in 2009 while he was still alive. The former BBC presenter and Radio 1 DJ died a year before the allegations emerged in a TV documentary last summer. The 30-page document outlined a number of findings. A total of 14 offenses recorded in relation to schools. His youngest victim was 8-year-old boy. The oldest was 47. Mainly his victims were girls. The earliest is from 1955 in Manchester. The last is from 2009. Offenses were carried out at the BBC between 1965 and 2006. Peak offending took place between 1966 and 1976. A total of 450 people have alleged that he did something bad to them. And actor Charlie Sheen didn't say whether his comments about Mayor of Los Angeles Antonio Villaraigosa partying with him in Baja for 2 hours and being able to drink with the best of them were untrue, but he did apologize if, quote, if any of my words have been misconstrued. Charlie, relax. All of your words have been misconstrued, or at least strewed. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. It's a copyright feature of this broadcast. Now news of AFAC! The Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, in his December report, said there are problems still existing in monitoring bulk flows of cash into and mainly out of Kabul International Airport. The two bulk currency counters they found in the airport were not easily accessible to customs officials. Neither was connected to the internet or a computer server. A new, very, very important person's VVIP lounge was built to provide easier boarding access for high-ranking officials, allowing transit without main customs screenings or the use of a currency counter. Department of Homeland Security officials told us, the Inspector General, their efforts to address these problems have stalled. Afghan officials have neither committed to connecting the machines to the internet or correcting other weaknesses that negatively impact the ability to monitor currency flows. Because money flowing out of Afghanistan for some reason. The Army, the Inspector General also reported, failed to ensure that Afghan translators were properly screened at the start of the Obama administration's troop surge, endangering soldiers they worked with, according to that Inspector General. And the British newspaper The Independent on Sunday reports the Afghan police charged with maintaining security in their own country as coalition troops pull out are still, quote, endemically corrupt and riven with problems including nepotism and drug abuse. Those are Foreign Office papers, the British Foreign Office, obtained by The Independent on Sunday. They disclose official concerns about the fate of Afghanistan and its chance of holding the Taliban at bay if its leaders failed to, quote, root out corruption throughout the ranks of the Afghan National Police. Quote, unless radical change is introduced to improve the actual and perceived integrity and legitimacy of officers within the Afghan uniformed police, then the organization will continue to provide an ineffective and tainted service to citizens for decades to come, unquote, the report. President Karzai accepted that widespread corruption was, quote, a bitter reality, but blamed it on the countries funding his government and security forces. The large part of corruption, he says, is hundreds of millions of dollars that are not ours. We shouldn't blame ourselves for that. That part is from others and imposed on us. That is to say, the $28 million a day we're spending to rebuild Afghanistan. There may, oh, and you, as I noted earlier, President Karzai paid a visit this week to President Obama in Washington. Another radio program has more insight into that event.
From Afghanistan Public Radio, where you're never more than a week away from a pledge drive.
From the newly depopulated presidential palace in downtown Kabul, home of the five-day oil change, I'm Mahmoud.
And speaking from my frugal hotel room in Washington, D.C., I'm Hamid. We're Beg and Bag, the top-up brothers. Welcome to another edition of Karzai Talk.
Today's program comes to you with the aid of our friends at Afghan Telecom. Nothing says I love you like a phone bill. So, my older brother, you are in Washington.
Oh, yes, and for the same reason that the American Willie Sutton supposedly said he robbed banks. Mm-hmm.
That's where the money is.
That's right.
Speaking of money, I assume you had a lovely exit from our beloved country?
Well, let me just say that the new VIP lounge opened just in time.
And closed shortly thereafter.
No, it'll reopen about 12 hours before my return flight lands.
So, my brother, the president, I mean, the other president, he treated you well?
Well, a working lunch is no state dinner, but I can get a state dinner every night back home.
You sure can. And we read in the pages of our daily newspaper that you and Mr. Obama agreed on important subjects.
Well, first, we agreed that we would not follow the American advice and example. And that our newspaper will continue to come out daily.
And they will leave some of their troops here after the date when they all leave.
Well, they have said they will turn over their detainees to us.
And that's important for our sovereignty.
It's also important for our budget.
Oh, how so, dear brother?
Well, if our guards can start to be the ones shaking down the detainees, that's less we have to pay them. since they gave in on that, I said it would be easier to grant legal immunity to any U.S. troops who may stay.
That's very important and very credible. Well, just like me assuring my customers that the Toyotas I sell them are covered by the factory warranty.
Don't sell cars like my brother.
Don't govern like my brother. Hello, you are on Cars I Talk.
Hello, this is Jahandar, long-time police lieutenant, first-time caller.
Jahandar, thank you for your service to our country.
Thank you. I was going to thank you for your service.
But during the screening, I told him you already thanked yourself about 3 million times.
Well, you can never have too many homes in Dubai.
Well, they're not making any more.
Oh, yes, they are.
So, Jahandar, the maid wants to clean my room, make it snotty.
Well, in the course of my duties, although not necessarily the most official of my duties, I sometimes have to fly out of the country on a moment's notice with some useful things in my possession.
Oh, we know the feeling.
And I was just wondering, when I'm going through customs, mm-hmm. how do I get bumped up from VIP status to VVIP status?
Well, it's not what you know.
And it's not who you know.
It's who knows what you know.
Trust us, we know.
Look, Jahandar,
yes.
Old Karzai family saying, money is like chalk dust. A little bit rubs off on everybody who comes near it. So, if I were you, I'd go to the excellent afgov.af website, look up the top customs officials, and sprinkle them with a little chalk dust.
You think that will help?
Couldn't hurt. That's less than we have to pay them.
And we do need to save. You know that frugal hotel my brother mentioned at the top of the show?
Yes.
For the duration of his visit, they had to install a fifth season.
And we don't expect you to come up with that chalk dust on your own.
No.
No, that's why God made the tennies.
Thanks for the call.
We had help today from the Afghan Friends of America Foundation. With friends like us, you don't need Hungarian.
Legal services for Karzai Talk. From the law firm of Ketchum and Newcomb, I'm Hamid.
And I'm Mahmoud. Stay tuned to APR and hear this episode repeated all day.
Or join us next time for another edition of Karzai Talk.
This is APR, Afghanistan Public Radio.
Listen to me, won't you let me help you, 'cause no one else will, believe me, nothing lasts forever, so the good book says, nothing lasts forever, get into your clothes, you can sleep when you're dead, you know. Share of worries, and I've lived under the clouds of fear. And you can hold on till your sorrows, forget about your tomorrows, darling. It's funny how you want to live when you think the end is near. Listen to me, nothing lasts forever. So the good book says, nothing lasts forever. Get into your clothes, you can sleep when you're dead, you know. Ooh, and every day you have is a blessing, and every smile's a friend you can lean on, and everyone you love is the dressing. Man, he was sitting up on top of that hill, and he said, it's a bitter pill to swallow, but forget about your tomorrows, darling. The big man didn't get you, but you know one day he will. Listen to me, nothing lasts forever. So the good book says, nothing forever. Get into your clothes, you can sleep when you're dead. Nothing, nothing, nothing ever lasts forever. Nothing ever lasts forever. Get into your clothes, you can sleep when you're dead. Get into your clothes, you can sleep when you're
clothes. You can sleep when you're dead.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you? The award-winning news of the warm. How'd that happen?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Few little items of interest on this topic today. Mangrove forests of the Sundarbans on the border between West Bengal, India, and Bangladesh are disappearing, taking endangered species like the Bengal tiger with them. Rapid deterioration in mangrove health is occurring there, as much as 200 meters of coast disappearing in a single year. A report published just this week by the Zoological Society of London, the ZSL, or the ZSL as they would call it, states that as human development thrives and global temperature continues to rise, natural protection from tidal waves and cyclones is being degraded at alarming rates. This will inevitably lead to species loss in this richly biodiverse part of the world if nothing is done to stop it. But wait, there's more. A new report warns that climate change driven by human activity already is affecting the American people and economy, with more frequent and intense heat waves, heavy downpours, and in some places, droughts and floods. A draft version of the National Climate Assessment was released this week. It warns that as the Earth continues to warm because of increasing levels of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, the health and livelihoods of many Americans and the ecosystems that sustain the country face frightening impacts. Sea levels are rising, oceans are becoming more acidic, glaciers and Arctic sea ice are melting. The National Climate Assessment, which is required under the Global Change Research Act of 1990, is presented to the President and Congress every 4 years, designed to provide a thorough overview of the status of climate science and climate change impacts. It came the same week, reports McClatchy newspapers, that the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration said U.S. temperatures last year were the highest since record-keeping began in 1895. The draft assessment, however, warns that human-induced climate change means much more than just hotter weather. It references increases in ocean and freshwater temperatures, frost-free days, and heavy downpours. There's also more extreme weather, including more frequent and intense winter storms along the West Coast and the coast of New England. Friday's draft assessment warns that the climatic shifts have affected and will continue to affect human health, water supplies, agriculture, transportation, and energy. They'll pose the greatest challenges to communities that are already facing economic or health-related problems and to species and habitats that already face other pressures, the assessment says. And risk experts are concerned that the twin threats of economic upheaval and accelerating climate change could collide over the next decade, delaying crucial adaptation efforts while exposing nations to unpredictable financial loss from disasters. The World Economic Forum, this is from Environment and Energy Daily, describes this superstorm of risks as a top hazard to the global economy through 2022 as world and corporate leaders prepare for their annual summit in Switzerland. Tougher resilience will be a key theme not only for assets like electric power networks, but also for the economy following years of punishing catastrophes. The business group, which runs Davos, that's what they're going to be meeting at next week or the week after, points to a dangerous intersection of rising risk and a declining ability to counter it. Ever denser cities worldwide are increasingly threatened by natural hazards as higher temperatures exacerbate drought, storms, and heat waves. Davos is concerned, ladies and gentlemen. News of the warm, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, just a follow-up from the Let Us Try file on the Army Corps of Engineers' destruction of that 40 acres of wetlands habitat in the San Fernando Valley, or as I call it, the San Pornando Valley. This is from the LA Weekly. Absurd, unnecessary social engineering and possibly illegal environmental tactics. That's what some politicians are calling the Corps' surprise destruction. Facing increasing criticism for bulldozing a cherished breed habitat and wetlands ecosystem in a city where most wetlands were long ago destroyed, Corps officials insisted the Federal Flood Control Agency had no choice, in part because cruising gay men and homeless campers had flocked there and endangered the public. That rationale is news to West Valley Division LAPD Lieutenant Anne-Marie Fuller, who for 6 months has overseen vice patrols in that area. She says she's unaware of homeless or lewd behavior problems besides those commonly seen in parks and woods patrolled by LAPD. It sounds kind of strange, she says. I'd never heard anything about a mounting threat to public safety. And State Senator Kevin DeLeon says, if they had a public safety problem in Central Park, New York, Golden Gate Park, or Balboa Park in San Diego, you'd never hear of them eviscerating 40 acres. It's absurd, says Lewis McAdams, president of the Friends of the Los Angeles River. I think it's homophobic and naturephobic, says the Corps. Let us try. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.490 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want at harryshearer.com. And KCRW.com, available for your smartphone and your smarter phone through Stitcher.com, and available as a free podcast and a freer podcast at KCRW.com. And it'd be just like the Corps of Engineers stopped trying if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Already, thank you very much. Uh-huh. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, In Exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. Thanks to Jenny Lawson here at WWNO-FM in New Orleans for help with today's broadcast. The email address for this broadcast and a playlist of the music heard here on, still there at harryshearer.com, where everything in the store is $5 with free shipping. Think of it, or don't. This broadcast is represented on Twitter. Join the nearly 80,000 followers at the Harry Shearer. Come on, followers. We're going over. We're going over the edge. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from New Orleans.